Andreas. Andreas.
It was my first year in New York, and Mario was a member of the Beginners Playwrights Unit at the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater, located at the old firehouse on 47th Street, very close to Broadway. Member playwrights would meet once a week there to give each other feedback on scripts selected for review. You had to climb up to the fourth floor of the firehouse, and then an additional floor on an incredibly narrow spiral staircase to reach the room where the unit was held. The wood floor was old and squeaky. A side glass ceiling with an open view of Manhattan's Midtown skyscrapers leaked when it rained. George was part of the professional playwrights unit where advanced, published and produced writers met. Once you saw George, you couldn't forget him. He's tall and lean, with unique features. He's introverted and seemingly absent-minded, and he has a vast knowledge of African-American history and culture. A real presence.
What Alan had, he would start you in one unit, and then after 2 years or 3 years or whatever, he would move you up to the next unit. What they would do is leave the scripts out in the hall, and during the week, people would come by and pick up the scripts, take them home, read them, and come back and discuss what they had read. So I would just see scripts from the other unit, and I would glance through them.
Eventually, Mario and I were allowed to join the professional playwrights unit and really got to know George and the other members. Meeting weekly for several years, our colleagues became sworn comrades in arms. Fred Cracker, Oscar Colon, Pedro Garcia, Michael Mejias, Elena Torres, T-Cat Ford, Carlos Serrano, Nancy Nevarez, Noemi Martinez-Cress, Noemi de la Puente, and George E. Joshua. The talent of these writers was immense, and under the wise leadership of Alan Davis III, the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater Playwrights Unit became our artistic home in New York. In time, Mario and I co-directed both units. George was born in Queens, New York in 1949. He now lives in Flatbush, Brooklyn. For decades, he had an administrative position working with the New York Police Department.
I worked in the police department for over 40 years, and there might be a handful of people that I consider my friend. You know, that's 40 years. I mean, I could exchange greetings and this and that. Away from the police department, I was still writing. I was involved with theater. The police department for me became like a job. The friends that I made in the police department I actually made when I first started working there back in the 70s. A friend of mine has a birthday coming up, very good friend of mine. He's a police officer, we work together. He's 86 years old in a couple of weeks. I remember I took him out on his birthday. This had to be about in the 80s or something like that. I took him to a concert. We both like music. Hugh Masekela, the late trumpet player, was performing with Herb Albert. The Bottom Line in the Village, which is no longer there. When I had my first show done, he brought his whole tennis club there. He brought the whole place out. You know, he had like about 20 people there. You know, in a small theater, it only sat like, I think, 74, 75 people. He's always supported me.
True to his real profession, George was always writing. George's plays are an incredibly rich source of knowledge about the experience of black people in the US. I'd only heard the half-accurate stories I was told about African Americans back in Germany at school, so it was a topic I did not remotely have a grasp on. One of his plays, Meditation on Dead Bones, is about New York in the 17th century, when slaves, former slaves, and freeborn blacks were all part of the city's makeup. In it, a character named Angola, a freed former slave, tries to escape with his lover, an enslaved woman whose master promises her that her daughter will be free. Angola wants to sail with all of them back to Africa. The tensions arising from the different statuses of the characters are complex. The hate we see directed towards a free black man is intense. And the character's collective struggle for independence and freedom is monumental. Another one of George's plays, When the Sunset Explodes, unfolds during the time of the Revolutionary War. It's a story of a father and a son who had found themselves fighting for opposite sides, one with the British forces and the other with the American rebels, both driven by the same noble promise of freedom. They have to face a white abolitionist traveling the country advocating for the end of slavery, while at the same time he keeps a black woman they know in common as his property. These plays are tragic, with a profound sense of suffering and pride. Reading them moved me deeply, and even more so, seeing them acted on stage.
I have been writing for a number of years. I had a play in 1984 at the 6th Street Theater, and it did unexpectedly well. It was called Across the Pond. It was a military piece. Now, I've been in the military, and this was like in 69 and 70. But at that time, I wasn't writing plays. I was just writing. I was writing short stories, poetry, and stuff like that. I got into plays like in about, I would say, 73 or something like that. Because at that time, theater was relatively cheap. Theater in New York at that time was basically segregated up until like about 1982.
Really?
Yeah. And so there were really like four or five locations where black and brown people would go. So everybody would be congregating in those places. But it was interesting because theater was limited in that sense. Everybody was together and there would be like fantastic talent there. I can remember seeing people in little readings and in small productions that today, if I said their name, the general public would know who they are. But I knew them as like somebody who you'd have a cup of coffee with or chit-chat with. Sam Jackson, he was in a reading of a friend of mine's. I got there early to accompany my friend and we all hung out. Denzel Washington, I saw him in a production, two-man production. In this two-man production, it was called When Chickens Come Home to Roost. He played Malcolm X. Yeah, yeah.
In 2008, Mario and I started a theater project about slavery through our company, One Heart Productions. Focused on the personal experiences of actors who were descendants of enslaved people and enslavers. We invited a few actors with this background and asked George to create a play based on their stories. The following scene takes place in the Plantation Haven, a run-down hotel. Longtime employee Moose resists Maggie, who is the owner, as she tries to break with the hotel's racist past.
Changes need to be made around here.
What kind of changes?
For starters, a name change is in order.
From the Plantation Haven?
The name should have been buried years ago.
The name packs a tradition.
Not the kind everybody can appreciate.
The name helps me feel close to your daddy.
Find another way to feel close to Daddy.
Big Jim had a purpose when he planted that name on this here establishment.
I have my own purpose.
Which might be?
To expand business.
When your daddy was alive, we ain't had no problem with the name.
These are different times. And frankly, I find the name offensive.
Now, you know how I feel about your daddy. I ain't never tried to hide it. He done plenty for me. Took me fishing, hunting, when nobody would cut me alone, except covered in pity or contempt. He shared stories about the mines he worked before buying this place and the dynamite sticks he used to use. Bought me drinks before I set off to boot camp and had a job waiting for me when I come back. The name meant something to Big Jim. And I say to uphold it is to uphold his memory.
Daddy was more than a name. He stuck on a hotel. The name has to go.
Now, if you insist on a name change, how about Plantation Haven 2?
No, Moose, we're going to leave the plantation days behind.
Oh, that's right. Just change the name. Change everything. We're losing the country. Why not lose the damn name, too? What happened to my America? The land our forefathers settled and built.
Which brings me to another thing. That flag behind the desk needs to join the name with an exit.
My flag?
Anybody else put a Confederate flag behind the desk?
That flag is our heritage. When things get tough, it gives me comfort. It's good enough to fly the Confederate monument grounds. It should be good enough to sit behind the desk.
Moose?
No, this is too much change, too quick.
Don't make me repeat myself.
Flags, the statues. What's next? Taking away General Robert E. Lee's birthday celebration?
It's a new day, a different day.
Can't nobody see the flag but me.
I know it's there so I can see it in my mind.
The name of the play is Birmingham Reunion.
All these companies had writers' units, and it was very easy to join if you wanted to for a minimal fee or sometimes nothing.
I think you told me once that you met Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman was one of the four co-founders of the Frank Silvera Writers' Workshop. Morgan Freeman, Gordon Lee Thompson, Billy Allen, and there's one other lady, I apologize, I can't recall right now, but Garland had been a director out in California, and he worked with the late Frank Silvera. So that's where the workshop got derived its name. And Morgan Freeman was in on it because, which is funny to think about now, he couldn't get any roles in any pictures. So he was trying to have a forum where the writers could write roles that he could do. I used to see him like twice a week, and he would be in the readings. He would play parts every time he sees something he could play. I remember he said once that if he could get a chance, he would play a chair if that's what they wanted him to play.
So you're saying because it was so segregated, yeah, it was very intimate and personal?
Yeah, yeah.
And accessible?
Accessible, and the talent was extreme. In terms of writing in the units, none of them that I mentioned, Garland or Morgan Freeman, dealt with the writing aspect. So in these different little small venues, I got a chance to work with people that later on would command thousands of dollars to teach at universities and colleges across the country. And I'm working with them for like $25, I think, was the top I paid. I studied with J.E. Franklin, Adrian Kennedy, the late Charles Fuller, Ed Bullins, Ron Milner. I remember maybe 3 or 4 years ago, Dramatists Guild magazine did a cover story and they featured four playwrights. Two of them, Charles Fuller and Adrian Kennedy, I had studied with.
So you were, in a way, constantly writing?
Yeah.
Flatbush Avenue is full of bodegas, cheap Chinese restaurants, 99-cent outlets, and fruit stands outside mini-markets. When I went to visit George in his neighborhood, he picked me up from the subway stop at Church Avenue, a very busy corner. His apartment is in a quieter area, just a few blocks away. He lives with his wife, Josefina.
Small television in there.
Yeah, hay una ensaladita también.
George's apartment could very well be the stage of The World According to Roscoe, a new play he's working on. In it, Oscar and Eunice, an older couple, find themselves trapped in their flat at the start of the COVID pandemic. Roscoe is recovering from a work-related accident, and Eunice, a nurse, is taking time off to help him.
In New York City, the sounds of sirens are haunting. Piercing the abnormal silence of a once bustling city, today the governor said the state could run out of ventilators soon.
At the current burn rate, we have about...
It's just me.
Good. Hate to think what would happen if it wasn't.
So you or the intruder?
Trump is both. Some governors across the country as he questions the need for more supplies. You get everything?
Mission accomplished.
Your gloves are still on.
I was waiting until after I took off my jacket.
You're supposed to take the gloves off first. Wash your hands, then take off the mask. That's the protocol. You need to remember these things.
Yeah.
It could be the difference between life and
death. Got it. Sometimes it's confusing. Like, is it 6 feet or 9 feet we're supposed to stand apart?
Outside, it's 6 feet. Inside, it doesn't matter.
Even that explanation sounds confusing.
We're in a pandemic. It's all uncharted territory. Just go with the science and what the doctors say.
You think they know about uncharted territory?
Better than we do.
That's not saying much. I don't know anything.
What did you get?
What you told me to get.
You forgot the list. You left it on the kitchen table.
I put what we needed in my head.
You sure you got everything?
Try me.
Milk?
Got it.
Whole wheat bread?
In keeping with your country roots. Got it.
Everything south is not country.
You've been telling me for 40 years.
And as long as you keep getting it wrong, I'll keep telling you.
Let's see. Milk, bread, lettuce, cheese, eggs, and a box of masks.
Just one box?
Had a tough enough time finding that.
They say everything is selling out.
No more freebies outside the church.
They charging now?
They don't have any more. Masks are scarce like everything else.
Well, the hospitals get first choice. As well they should. And I still can't find anything online.
Proves my point. This COVID thing can't end soon enough for me.
You and about 100 million other people around the world.
Crazy out there. Amazon deliveries aren't even safe in the lobby.
Uncivilized.
Pandemic can't bring out what's not already inside.
It would be nice if a vaccine came along.
If one did, after the photo op where they showcase a black, who do you think would be the first group to grab a supply?
I wasn't born yesterday.
On second thought, they might not have to hook or crook their way to the front. Tuskegee still rings a bell.
Cynical.
Look who's talking. I prefer cautious.
The world according to Roscoe Xavier Jones.
I'm a survivor. Caution helps me do what survivors do. Survive. Oh. The pharmacy's charging twice as much as they did last week. I refused to pay it, so I left. I hit pay dirt at a bodega.
One box.
I might try again later in the week. They was too much. Some Haitian dude wearing one of those Jamaican Rastafarian hats got into a hassle with the guy behind the counter. The Haitian dude heard me ask for a box of masks. He jumped in and verbally attacked the worker. You're exploiting the people. African people can't catch it.
Try telling that to the African descended people laying up in the hospital praying for a ventilator.
The guy behind the counter yelled at the dude, put a mask on or get out. I put a 20 on the counter, grabbed the box that was put out for me, left the 20, and didn't wait for the change.
You could have paid what they wanted at the pharmacy and come out cheaper.
When I left the bodega, they were yelling at each other, one in Creole and the other in Spanish.
I can totally understand why the hospital needs the first and the best. That's the battleground. It must be frustrating to be on the short end of things, like fighting with one arm tied behind your back.
I'm glad you're not working and dealing with all this.
Thanks to your back injury.
Better here on lockdown with me.
The scene we just heard is from an earlier version of the script. George already revised it. He writes and rewrites methodically even after his plays are considered ready. George and I spent the whole afternoon together that day, talking about his plays, art, politics, and the state of the world. I admire him for his steadfastness when it comes to his work. He is constantly writing and rewriting, mirroring life through the eyes of his characters. He told me that he was always most interested in history, but recently he's wanted to write about people living in the present time.
People just being them, the situation we find ourselves in, and how do we deal with it, how do we manage it, and then surviving it also maintain our humanity and the perspective that it doesn't always have to be like this.
George does not seem to mind if his plays get produced. He writes them anyway. I find that immensely encouraging. The question of how to stay relevant to my audiences is always on my mind. And through his example, he shows me that as long as my stories are rooted in real life, they remain relevant and current. George is truly talented. I love working and collaborating with him. And above all, I'm very grateful that I can call him my friend. A very special thank you to Charisse Green and Steve Jones, who played Maggie and Moose, and Angela Rostick and Charles Black, who played Roscoe and Eunice. The music credits for this episode go to Universal Field, Serge Quadrado, and Pras Canal, generously published on pixabay.com/music.